This episode of Policing Matters is brought to you by Lexipol, the experts in policy, training, wellness support, and grants assistance for first responders and government leaders. To learn more, visit lexipol.com. That's L-E-X-I-P-O-L.com. Welcome back to Policing Matters on PoliceOne.com. I'm Jim Dudley, and you're in for a treat today. Hey, don't forget to check us out on the YouTube channel as well. Hey, we've spoken about evidence-based policing, and it sounds pretty self-explanatory, but what does it really mean? Have we accepted science in developing law enforcement strategies? Do we have a master list of best practices that we all follow uniformly across the nation? Will we ever get to the point where we can go all in to drug use on the streets, problem issue, turn that page in the manual and get to solving the problem that somebody else has figured out? Well, our guest today is Dr. Jerry Radcliffe, PhD, an esteemed scholar with a background in policing that started in the UK and led him to teaching at Temple University. He's authored several books such as Reducing Crime, A Companion for Police Leaders, and Evidence-Based Policing, The Basics. Hey, I have a copy right here, one of my manual go-to manuals. Yes, he also hosts this podcast called Reducing Crime. Be sure and check that out. Well, hey, welcome to Policing Matters, Jerry Radcliffe.
Thanks, Jim. It's lovely to be here, mate.
So let's all get on the same page to begin with. What is evidence-based policing?
Well, I mean, if we're going to go for a straight up definition, I think one of my favorites used to be from the British College of Policing. They've changed it recently, but I like the old one, so I'm sticking with that. And it's police officers and staff create, review, and use the best available evidence to inform and challenge policies, practices, and decisions. And there's so much about this that I like. And I think a piece of it is in your intro, you were saying just now, you know, have we accepted science in developing law enforcement strategies? And I think it's important to note that most of the time it's actually police officers, it's cops who are developing the strategies. Now, guys like me can come along and help you understand whether or not it's working. But increasingly, we've got police officers who can do that and who are doing that in their agencies, because it has to be police officers doing it. So guys like me, we can help. But I think it's really about police officers and staff trying different things and seeing whether they work. This has to be embraced by policing. And I think in a bizarre way, I'm almost trying to make myself redundant here. But I mean, you were in the job for many years and, you know, have you ever had that feeling when a senior officer kind of says, well, in my experience, and in your head, you're kind of going, yeah, no, that's not going to work. Well, evidence-based policing takes the guesswork out of that to some degree and says, okay, well, look, it might work. Let's test it. Let's have a look at the data and see where the data lead us. And so I like the idea it's been done by police. I like the idea that it's challenging and informing decisions and policies and practice. And it's not, you know, it's using the best available evidence. And if I can go on a little bit more, I think it's got a couple of components to it. I think a piece of it is using the existing evidence where we have it. So it'd be, you know, there is evidence out there about what works and what doesn't around some aspects of policing. So it'd be great to do more of what works and less of what doesn't work. But the second part, you know, so for example, in that, say, take shootings, because I know we were just talking about Phil Cook, you had on a previous episode, more hotspots policing and less gun buybacks, for example, because we've got evidence on both of those. But the second part, to me, that's about helping police departments actually figure out what they're currently doing is working or not. And to better understand all the innovative practices that police officers are coming up with right now in so many different places. It's a pretty exciting time. And I think it's here to stay. For me, evidence-based policing is one of kind of the four main pillars of where policing is in this kind of 21st century post-Ferguson, post-George Floyd world. It has to be harm-focused. It has to be more intelligence-led, it has to be more problem-oriented, and it has to be evidence-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love your website, your blog. You have so many great tutorials for someone new to evidence-based policing. One of them is the hierarchy of policy decision making. I love that. I teach police and public policy at my school. Can you explain that, the hierarchy of policy decision making?
Yeah, that kind of this feels a little inside baseball, really, doesn't it? You know, how to drive all the listeners away with that kind of terminology. Bloody hell.
No, I mean, I think really it, you know, I think sometimes when we use a phrase that comes maybe from academia, we do scare people away. But in reality, when we get to the details, it's something that cops know and something cops do, but, you know, we don't put a formal title to it, but you do here.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, it's about helping people understand that, especially when they're new to reading research, and I think, really, is the reality that, look, some types of study and some types of research are better at getting to the answer about whether something police are doing works or not. And, you know, for example, often it's held up that randomized control trials are the sort of highest standard of study that you can have. And they're a bit like high quality medical trials. And I think implicitly people kind of understand that. I mean, I hope most people wouldn't go to their doctor and, you know, or they would hope that their doctor would give them some medication that had undergone, you know, substantial, significant medical trials in the most robust way possible, as opposed to just having the GP wander and go, here, try this. Does it work? I don't know. I just got a feeling about it, but we haven't got any tests on it. But yeah, give it a go. Fingers crossed. You know, at that point, I'm going to the stuff that's been studied because I've got a little bit more faith in it. The tricky part around policing is high quality research isn't always easy to conduct, but that doesn't mean that we can't do something. So I basically try and help people like cops and students understand that we have a scale from sort of zero, this isn't very good, up to five. And, you know, randomized trials are at five. But as long as you can have a study that's kind of at least a three, there's some kind of a comparison area, it's okay. And we can call that kind of stuff evidence. Now, the downside is, now you're not going to be offended as a former chief here, the random thoughts of a police chief, you know, like in a newspaper article or even an academic like myself. Yeah, unless we've got a study to back it up, that I'm afraid that counts as zero on the scale. It's fun to listen to, but, you know, I wouldn't take it to the bank.
Okay. Listen, I have so many colleagues, and you do as well, who are scholars with PhDs in criminology. What do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of those who opine on police practices without practical application? Now, I don't lump you in with them because you've got, you know, a decade or so of police experience under your belt. And so you know what it's like to wrestle around in the dirt with somebody. And you know, I go into some of these meetings and, you know, some of my colleagues are wrestling around with the idea of de-escalation. And I always think, you know, in my inner narrative that, hey, try wrestling around on the ground with someone and talk about de-escalation. You know, it takes two to tango.
Yep.
And there's this expectation that you are going to reason with someone who has been totally irrational up till now.
Well, I'm just impressed that that's the quality of your inner monologue, because my inner monologue is often going WTF, you know, right at that particular moment. Look, it's really tricky. I think we have to put this concept of, you know, experience into some sort of perspective, especially in this new world. The last decade of policing has very sort of grown evidence-based policing, and we're also in a kind of post-Ferguson kind of world. I worry a little bit, and this is probably shooting myself in the foot, because I thank you for mentioning I do have like a decade in policing, but I worry that we tend to valorize lived experience a little bit too much in policing, just as much as we absolutely do it in academic criminology. You know, if I'm sick, I don't need my doctor to have experienced the same disease to be able to treat me. Because, you know, if I end up having, and I hope I don't, but if I end up having prostate problems, that would kind of rule out half the planet who could turn out to be really good surgeons and could help me out. But I guess I do want my doctor to know what it's like to have prostate problems and to have my best interests at heart. So, I mean, if I have a policing background, but if all I bring to the table is that well-worn phrase, in my experience, well, honestly, you could get that anywhere. And if you're in policing, you don't need it. You have your own experience. But evidence-based policing, to me, it's about moving away from random experience, opinion, and hunches. Look, experience is a good story, and it might be insightful, but in the end, and to be a little bit brutal, my experiences are interesting, but they still represent, in academic terms, a biased sample with an N of one. And so I think previous policing experience can certainly help. Certainly help understand the pressures and the stresses that police officers and police leaders are under. But I think we should be careful not to over-valorize that, because then it's really difficult to move forward as a science. Experience has a place at the table, but people who can bring science to the table. Now, if they don't bring in science and they have no police experience, then at that point, I'm wondering what the hell they're even doing at the table, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some policing scholars with, you know, policing backgrounds that feel that their experience is all they need. But I worry that in a more data-driven world, that again represents a biased sample with an N of one. Equally, there are quite a few policing scholars nowadays, and increasingly more so, who don't have a sworn background, but they are prepared to take the time to build the relationships with police departments and do the kind of hard yards to really understand the business. You know, I'm thinking of people like Rylan Simpson, Corey Haberman, Eric Pisa, Natalie Todak, Jesse Huff, Anthony Braga, who I know you've talked about on your podcast before, and look, many others. So they're all willing to spend time in a police car or go to CompStat meetings and actually understand the business. So, I worry, let's not make having been in a uniform the price of entry, because it might exclude people who can bring something to the table. But yeah, it's a balance. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally get it. But I have a suggestion for you. Tell a couple of your war stories around a water cooler or a coffee pot, and you'll grow your N of 4 to 5, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think there is a difference. Either you come in with a policing background, and people in policing, you know, they've been hammered by academics in the past. I spend a lot of time just building relationships with departments before I even start having conversations with them, because they have to know that I'm probably not in it to jam them up. As I used to tell Chuck Ramsey, the former police commissioner, look, if I find something bad, I'll tell you. If I find something good, I'll tell everyone. And I think a piece of this is just building relationships, because, you know, you can't blame cops in many regards. They have been burned by academics in the past. You know, they come and rape and pillage you for all your data, sit in the back of the car, write terrible things about you, and then go and make their academic careers. It's like, well, great. You just burn that police department for working with any researchers and advancing the field for the next 20 years. Thanks very much. Yeah. So having it establishes a modicum of trust, which is great. But I worry that we overvalorize that. And I think we should be open to the possibility that there are other people without policing backgrounds who can bring something to the table. But if I'm sitting in a meeting and they don't bring any of this to the table, then we need a smaller table and they don't need to be at it.
Okay. All right. I get
I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned suddenly about table size. I don't know how we ended up here, right?
Okay. That's a different podcast on furniture. Hey, one of the all-time, feeding right into that, one of the great all-time adages is we've always done it this way, right? I'm sure you've heard that a million times. Are we getting close to changing that paradigm and accepting different tactics and strategies based on evidence-based policing or not? What are the hurdles? How can we convince some of the old guard who say, no, we're not doing that. We don't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it continues to be a struggle. I think this is a very slow process to actually get there. I mean, yeah, we've always done it this way. I think there's an equally appropriate adage, which is the one I've heard, which is cops are very optimistic. It's the one I use. Cops are very optimistic. They only hate two things: how we're doing it right now and change. And it's a struggle, right? But when it's not necessarily a field, I mean, this is where I probably differ a little bit from Bill Bratton, who calls it a profession. I'd love to call it a profession. But, you know, when you look at where a lot of professions are these days, there's continuous learning. There's continuous education processes. You look at medicine, you look at engineering, you look at architecture. All these fields have these sort of continuous enhancement processes. Nursing is the same. We don't really do that. It's kind of you, I mean, if you come in at the academy, unless you go to like the FBI National Academy or you go to IACP meetings or something like that, where you can actually learn a little bit more, there isn't a huge incentive. I mean, you take some promotion exams, but have you seen some of them with promotion books? They're brutal. And so there isn't really a lot of incentive to learn better practice about what's kicking around. And so there is a tendency to, you know, for people with some years in the job to fall back on experience. And I kind of understand that. But we have to keep moving forward. I'm a believer in incremental change because we've got people's lives in our hands, right? And we learn more about what works and what doesn't. I think if you've been, I mean, I joined the job this year, I'm coming up on 40 years. I joined the job 40 years ago. We didn't know anything about what worked and what didn't in policing in the early mid 1980s. We know a great deal more and we know more about how to develop that. But, you know, incremental change, I'm fine with that. These whole scale changes worry me a little bit because sometimes a good starting point is to understand why have we always done it that way before we start kind of tweaking with it. But you're right. I think people use that too much as an excuse to resist change and resist anything new. I mean, cops are naturally cynical, right? I mean, it's just a trait I've always admired and appreciated, but it's a new world. You know, post George Floyd, post Ferguson, there are a lot more eyes on policing. There's a lot more transparency of data. And if we don't keep innovating and changing, it's going to be imposed on policing from outside. And it's going to be a lot worse than if we do it ourselves.
Yeah, we're already seeing a little bit of that with some of the DOJ consent decrees and changing departments based on maybe anecdotal evidence. Hey, I'd like to get more about how agencies can make the shift to evidence-based policing. But first, I'd like to take a moment and thank our sponsor. Lexapol empowers first responders and public servants to best meet the needs of their residents safely and responsibly. Serving more than 2 million public safety and government professionals in over 8,000 agencies and municipalities, Lexapol offers a range of solutions that includes policies, training, behavioral health resources, news and analysis, and grant assistance services for law enforcement, fire and rescue, EMS, local government, and other agencies dedicated to public safety. To learn more, visit lexipol.com. That's LEXIPOL.com. And we're back, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jerry Radcliffe, author, former police officer, and professor on evidence-based policing. Well, we hear about justice and data. What does that mean? It seems that everything we do in policing is held to a standard based on racism in car stops, in vehicle or pedestrian stops, citations, even in the use of technology, which I think should eliminate that racial issue altogether. How can we have justice data?
So I believe the American expression is you just threw me what's called a hospital pass. I'm leaning very gently towards that third rail. Look, this is a really very tricky area. I think it's tricky because I don't think we're having honest conversations right now across the United States. I think people are using data to drive agendas in a lot of cases, and I don't think they're using it necessarily that honestly. I think what we have is what's called a denominator problem in a lot of discussions around policing, especially around policing of communities of color. What you're saying, a frequent claim I see is that policing must be racially biased because stops of people of color are disproportionate compared to the population rates of black and brown people in many cities, right? Now, look, I find that to be shockingly naive about how the world actually works and how policing is functioning in the 21st century. Some people might make mistakes, but when I hear it from smart people, I start to worry that that's a little disingenuous. So I'm supposed to be upfront for a whole bunch of reasons to do with decades of systematic. I have to say this, otherwise I'm going to get cancelled. But I do actually recognize, even as a newcomer 20 something years ago to the country, that for a whole bunch of reasons to do with decades of systematic racism in everything from medical care to education, from housing, banking and job provision, racial minorities in the US have had fewer chances and opportunities. And as a result, can often be the communities in which crime clusters, right? So through no fault of the vast majority of the people who actually live there. So to begin with, our large cities have a problem with racial bias in crime victimization. So, you know, put yourself in the position of a police chief. Now, we know, for example, from decades of hotspot policing research that concentrating police resources and cops in high crime areas can reduce crime and violence. But of course, look, if you send the cops there, they're going to work. They're going to do stops. They're going to make arrests. So everything from your pedestrian stop data to your arrest data and even innocent mere encounters and conversations will all appear to be racially disparate, because it is. They are. You know, we've sent the cops specifically to those areas where people are being victimized. But being racially disparate isn't necessarily racially biased. Now, you know, you could say to a police chief, you could solve this problem by pulling the cops out of the high crime areas and redistribute them to the safer neighborhoods. But there'd be less reason to do proactive work and probably less racial disparity. But who the hell is going to actually do that? You're going to leave our poorest and most vulnerable communities without any kind of government protection? It's nuts. So, yeah, I think at the moment we're not having very honest conversations. And I think when people don't use data wisely, or they use naive statistics to make political points, that's really what they're doing. And you can see the results, because it's driving depolicing that occurred after Ferguson and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one. I think we need to have more mature conversations. I think that start with the nature of the bias in victimization rates as the base rate. And then we compare police interventions to that. But I don't think as a society we're having the maturity of those kind of conversations yet, Jim.
Yeah, absolutely, totally agree with you. I've seen it, you know, when people adopt programs, they adopt them in name maybe. There's great evidence-based policing enforcement programs like Operation Ceasefire out of Boston with Tony Braga and Kennedy and Peel. And we've seen cities adopt Operation Ceasefire in name, and they don't go through the process. They don't do all the things that they need to make it successful, because they're afraid of alienating segments of the community. And then they point to it as a failure, when really the failure was not in the implementation. So,
you're not wrong at all, Jim. I think, but I also think politicians love to buy into the buzzwords of some of these things, but what they're not prepared to do is invest in it, because they want all the benefits without really having to pay for it. And it does come to a degree of implementation. They don't, you know, often these things work because people put a lot of hard work into making them work. And there's a tendency to kind of go, you know, people aren't so invested when they're not the people that innovate it. So it's like, take this other idea that somebody else got all the kudos for doing it, like you to do it. People don't buy into it so well. And the politicians want the benefits and the kudos for saying they brought it, but they don't actually want to spend years implementing it properly to actually make it work for the citizens. There's a lot of hit and run politics out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, as far as evidence-based policing strategies, what can be done with the idea of a low cost, using, you know, the minimum of personnel, but maybe measurably affecting crime? Can we reduce crime by just maybe flipping a couple of light switches rather than retooling our whole agency?
Well, it's been around. I'm going to be really boring here, I suspect. It's been around for a long time, but I worry sometimes that people get excited by the new buzzwords. You know, it's evidence-based this and intelligence-led that. And I'm guilty as everybody else. I still think we should be harm-focused, intelligence-led, problem-oriented, and evidence-based. And problem-oriented policing is one of those ones that I still really push, because there's so much evidence that it actually works. And if you do it well and you do it cleverly, you do what, you know, former police commissioner Chuck Ramsey once said to me. He says, I love it when I can get other branches of government to spend their money to solve my problem. And problem-oriented policing has become incredibly boring. I know everybody reads about the SARA model in their promotion manuals. They skim through that chapter, answer a couple of questions, and then never worry about it. Oh, nobody joins policing to sort of go to meetings with the city council about putting in streetlights or curbing traffic. But it actually works, and it's boring as hell, but it actually achieves the goals of what a lot of people join the job for. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of situational crime prevention. I'm a big fan of problem-oriented policing. I'm a big fan of getting other people to spend their money to solve our problem. Because we can always solve problems by putting a cop on a corner, but that's incredibly expensive, and then that cop is stuck there. Whereas if we can get other people, and if we can use our brains to think about how we could re-engineer the environment, the built environment, just make schools a bit safer or the streets a bit safer, and actually bring in engineering type changes, or look at the, you know, really figure out what criminal opportunities are being created and get shops to bring in better security systems, get them to spend their money to solve our problem. It's problem-oriented policing. It's kind of boring, but it gets the job done.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in part. And I think actually your one of your phrases you just mentioned is going to be highlighted to advertise the show. But, you know, as far as COVID and Ferguson pushed some other opinions on who should be taking care of the drug problem, who should be taking care of homeless issues and quality of life issues. And I feel like we've handed the car keys of the drug problem over to public health a decade ago. And what's happened? We've had an increase of overdose deaths in America from 20,000 in 10 years to over 100,000 annually. And part of it's because of, you know, fentanyl and some other drug innovations. But sometimes police are called back. You know, we had civilian groups handle calls for the mentally ill or people in crisis. And now police get called into that extreme crisis mode because the civilians aren't making it happen. And they don't want to wrestle with a naked guy with a stick or a golf club out on the street. And so the police...
who does?
Who does? Nobody does, but the police end up being the ones... Yeah. Called to solve the problem. So I get what you're saying. And yeah, I'd love public health. Here's a $5 billion go handle drugs and homeless and mental illness. But they don't always do a great job. And the police are often called back to clean it up.
Yeah, well, so I would argue that those types of initiatives don't really fall under the mantle of problem-oriented policing, predominantly for the reason that you're pointing out. They don't seem to work that well. And I think, you know, so, you know, we have, if you have a homelessness crisis, for example, in the, I've been working on a project in Philadelphia in the transit system, you know, the problem-oriented policing approach, rather than having social workers come in, will probably be along the lines of, okay, let's try and better understand why the transit system is attractive to the homeless community. And think more about addressing that than trying to deal with it once they've already decided to come in and inhabit the transit system. But coming back to the other issue, yeah, you're right. Well, I mean, I love it here, don't get me wrong. So don't get me canceled or thrown out of the country. But one in the last 20 something years living here, and this is probably everywhere, right? But I've learned that, you know, we have a tendency to look for technological solutions to problems. And I don't think that they exist in a lot of cases. But the other side is, and this comes back to this notion about, you know, handing off some of this work to other organizations. The American taxpayer would like everything and pay for nothing. And a piece of that I worry about is that, as you say, I don't think with these co-responder models or handing things over to social workers that necessarily we're getting value for money from that. And that will be the death knell of those programs. Because if you think about all the calls that, I mean, I published an open access piece on public health calls for service in Philadelphia. You can find it on search for it in Google. But what we found is that, you know, in terms of mental health calls, they originate in a lot of other calls that come into police, like crime and violent calls. So you're still having to send the police. Then if you're sending the social workers after that, you're essentially paying for two groups of people. And I don't think taxpayers are prepared to put up with that unless you can really prove you're getting massive improvement in outcomes. And I don't think we are. For me, we gave all of these jobs to the police because it was the cheapest option and they were going to have to go anyway to make the scene safe. It strikes me as far more cost effective to think more about police recruiting and make very clear to people that it is a crime job, but it's also a social service job. So they have a better understanding of what they're joining up and then train them better for that role. Why don't we just train police officers to be better at that social service function than hire a whole bunch of people that cities can't really afford and bring them in to do what is often a duplication of effort. So I think the piece of this is thinking about the cost benefit work around whether these things are really producing I get that they make people feel better, but the reality is that we often give jobs to the cops because it's one of the cheapest options out there. Because when the social workers are not working on the social work problem, they're not doing anything else. When the cops are not doing the social work, they're going to traffic accidents. They're dealing with a crime problem. They're stopping suspicious people. They're doing business checks. They're executing search warrants. They're doing all the other functions that we want them to do. It strikes me that, you know, there's a push to pull policing out of things. And I would actually argue there's a need to reverse that and actually improve the training for policing to do the wide range of functions that they already do.
Okay. Hey, respectful of your time, and so thankful to have you on the show, Jerry Radcliffe. Hey, what are you working on these days? Where can we find your work?
Yeah, it's funny you talked. I mean, I was just talking about that a moment. I just finished evaluating a program run by the Scepter Transit Police in Philadelphia, and just doing what I was talking about. They paired social workers with a team of officers who were tasked with encouraging the vulnerable population who inhabit the transit system to move to treatment or shelter. It was fascinating. My graduate student, Haley White, and I spent a year doing field work in and around the city subway system with great cops. They really cared about the people they encountered, but good police officers too. We found slightly better results with the social workers than when the officers were working alone. But the social workers came at significant cost. So, you know, it's like as economist Thomas Sowell once said, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. I hope to be able to, I mean, if people are interested in more about this, I hope to be talking about it at this year's up-and-coming IACP conference in Boston.
Yeah, well, I hope to buy you a beer in Boston this year.
Hey, absolutely. Only one? Come on, step up, Jim.
Well, then it's your turn, and then
fair
it'll
enough.
Be my turn again.
No, that's fair.
All right, Dr. Jerry Radcliffe, PhD, esteemed scholar, author, professor, former cop. Reducing Crime is his podcast. And hey, if you haven't bought this book, buy it. Great things in there. I talk about your stuff in my classes all the time. Cops should know from your book what we should be thinking about in different strategies and tactics in dealing with crime. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thanks, Jim. It's been a pleasure, mate.
All right, to our great listeners and viewers, check us out and drop me an email at policingmatters@policeone.com. Let me know what you think about the episode. Have any questions? Check out the link below, and you can go to Jerry Radcliffe's website and look at his blog, what he's talking about, and really good stuff there. All right. Take good care. I hope to talk to you again real soon. Stay safe. See you later.